This is the Tasman Report, with stories about a new committee structure for council, submissions to government on the RMA replacement bills, what to do first before building a granny flat, mooring licences and the Life Jacket Library, feedback for the local alcohol policy, and an update on the post-June-July floods recovery. For the 2025-28 triennium, council has streamlined its committee structure. This is to include a full council and two main standing committees, the Strategy, Finance and Performance Committee and the Environment, Regulatory and Operations Committee. The structure is supported by a new six-weekly information forum that has been designed to handle information only. Now, this structure reduces the number of committees from the previous term so that it aligns with the new internal operational units. Council Chief Executive Leonie Ray says the streamlined committee framework aims to improve operational efficiency for both elected members and staff.
But when you get down to nitty-gritty of how you actually work it out, you have to work through all the agendas that have come through the last triennium, having a look at which bring out all those decision reports and then allocating them to specific committees. What is those strategic things that full council have to focus on that only full council can approve? And then where the other ones all slot in and naturally have a synergy. So if you talk about the strategy, finance and planning, we shouldn't be doing our planning without the oversight of the actual budgets. We shouldn't have driving strategic direction if we don't understand how that associates with the budget. And it's always a bit disconnected. Strategy and policy was over here in a one committee talking about direction setting, and then 4 weeks later something will go to full council about the financial position of council. No synergy, quite, they didn't sort of bring the two together. And I brought the two together in our organisation, so now we have strategy and finance together, and they will report through as one.
And the community will notice a major difference in process at council meetings, because the role of the new information forum is to receive and discuss reports, leaving full council to focus on informed decision making.
You'll spend less time listening to councillors going through a whole lot of information. You'll be actually listening to their debate around decisions, so you understand how they're making those decisions. Then also, if you want information about something, we've got an information forum where all the information will go to them, and it's all going to be public, and then they can get information, but they can actually weave their way through it, because it'll be nice. The agendas will be very much about information around certain parts of the business, so they can chop it up. So into the digital innovation program, they can actually specifically go to that part of the agenda. Much more efficient for them. And I believe it will create more debate, because long meetings full of information take away the focus of the decisions. And that's where we want their brain to be working on, is the decisions, not all the information.
Council Chief Executive Leonie Ray talking about the new council committee structure. And you can see the meeting schedule for the whole year on the council website. You're listening to Tasman Report, a fortnightly news wrap about what's happening in your council. Late last year, central government released four submissions, the two bills that will replace the Resource Management Act. They are the Planning Bill and the Natural Environment Bill. Submission deadline is 4:30 p.m. Friday the 13th of February. So given that time frame, I asked Barry Johnson, the Environmental Policy Manager, what approach was being taken to get the submissions drafted in time.
We're working through them and to find out what it does mean for Tasman. We're looking over the bills with a Tasman lens, I guess you could say, to understand the implications for the region as a unitary authority. So the bills had their first reading before Christmas. They were referred to the Select Committee. It has opened the process for submissions. It's called for submissions, and that is open till the 13th of February. And then the Select Committee will then hear presentations from submitters, and it will have to report back by the middle of the year to Parliament on its recommendations for any changes to the bills. As a unitary, the bills would require Tasman to produce three new plans, or as they're termed in the new proposed legislation, three chapters of a single plan. They are a regional spatial plan, land use plan and a natural environment plan. And they would constitute three chapters of one overall plan. The regional spatial plan is kind of an overarching strategy. So it's a 30 to 50 year forward-looking strategy that will identify where and how Tasman will grow in the future. Underneath that will be a land use plan, which will implement the urban growth components of the regional spatial strategy, and that will basically replace the land use chapters of the current Tasman Resource Management Plan. And the third piece, of course, is our natural environment plan we will have to produce. And again, that will replace the similar pieces of the current Tasman Resource Management Plan.
That was Barry Johnson, Environmental Policy Manager. And for details about how you can make a submission on the replacement bills for the Resource Management Act, go to Shape Tasman and check out the page Resource Management Reform. And you're listening to Tasman Report. There are new rules now for small standalone dwellings, sometimes called granny flats. National Environmental Standards for Detached Minor Residential Units 2025 allows simple single-storey standalone dwellings up to 70 square metres to be built without a building consent, as long as they meet strict conditions and are built by authorised professionals. Resource Consent Manager Katrina Lee unpacks the new rules as they apply to Tasman.
The council website has been set out now with some good step-by-step processes. In two parts, though, which is really helpful because it's not just about resource consent, it's about the building consent exemptions as well. So we've set that out. So there's two links, so it's really clear for those both processes. We encourage people to go to bring up the customer services desk and talk to a duty planner at the same time as also a duty building officer. Where we've got a national environmental standard like this for granny flats, if you don't meet that, then a resource consent is going to be needed and you'll need to refer to that, our Tasman Resource Management Plan. Now, also realising that this council is a unitary authority, so we have the opportunity to work through that, has a one-stop shop for regional consent issues and districts. So it's really helpful that you can come to us in one place. So basically, you work through the NES rules. So there's a section in there and work through those rules as to if you don't meet one of those, then we also, there's some other triggers that could trigger it through, for example, if you're in a rural zone, connecting to services, you may not have the reticulation like you do in a residential area, so you still need to comply with wastewater rules. We've also got overlays in the TRMP, including the coastal environment area. So, for example, if you're within 200 metres of the coastline, you'll need a resource consent still because it's still a building. And also you have to consider the site's of cultural significance.
Resource Consent Manager Katrina Lee. And something to look out for when thinking about granny flats, they are referred to in three ways, as granny flats, then small standalone dwellings, and as detached minor residential units. For the full checklist, maps and planning advice, search Granny Flat Exemptions Tasman District Council and follow the links on the council website. That page explains how the National Granny Flat Exemption fits with Tasman's own resource consent rules and what to do if your project does not meet the exemption criteria. You're listening to Tasman Report, and whether or not you want to agree with your calendar, we're already 1 month down for 2026, and with that, we're right in the midst of summer. At council, no group is more aware of this than our hard-working Harbour Master team. And it's been a busy start to summer for Harbour Master Pete Renshaw, retrieving a quad bike in the Motueka Estuary, remedying an oil leak from a sunken yacht, and taking on landlubber duties such as surveys at the Golden Bay A&P show.
I think it's a great way of being seen in the community and making sure everyone knows we're still here, and then, you know, who to call when things, or when they need us, I guess. I wouldn't say when things go wrong, you want to call the police or Coast Guard when things go wrong. But if you have a cause of concern and want to get in touch, seeing us around the place is a big help. And I think certainly at the A&P show over in Takaka this year, I was incredibly busy over there. We had our small boat there and people could come and jump on board. And even through the pouring rain, I think we did over 50 or 60 boat safety surveys for Safer Boating New Zealand. Real valuable sort of data, as well as having some really meaningful conversations.
A big one for us is
life jackets as well this summer. So people generally are pretty good on vessels. What we're seeing, there's a lot of people going out on stand-up paddle boards, and I'm sure they're intending on just staying around the beach, but very quickly, they decide to go around the islands at Tata or around to Split Apple Rock, and at that point you're going way too far off the shore with an offshore breeze. It would be very easy for you to be washed out to sea and not get back again. So any craft, including your paddleboard, you need to be wearing a life jacket and have two forms of communication. And we're just not seeing that at the moment. It is about having the right form of communication, though. So, you know, if you're just on your paddleboard, a whistle and your voice is more than enough for at the beach. If you decide to go a bit further, then, hey, take your cell phone with you in a waterproof bag. You know, it's about having the right equipment. We're not saying go out and buy lots of fancy stuff. So just having the right things with you at the right time. And, yeah, that's not what we're seeing at the moment.
But one positive aspect regarding the life jackets, we have started an initiative in collaboration with ACC to provide life jacket libraries at various points around the region. Can you sort of enlighten us on how that's being received?
Yeah, so it's been a really, really good initiative. ACC approached me in the winter and it sort of was progressing a bit slowly, and then all of a sudden these life jackets arrived in sort of mid to late December. So we sort of scrambled a bit to try and get them deployed around Christmas and New Year. We've managed to get life jacket library at the beach in Kaitiritiri by the boat ramp there. That's probably our busiest one, with life jackets going out daily from there, of various different sizes. And then the next one would be Totoranui and Pahara. And then we're looking at rolling out one more, which we're hopeful will go out over in Collingwood, nearer the northern part of our region. So far, they're all being received really well, and we've not had any reports of jackets going missing, which was quite a big concern when we started the initiative. But people seem to be pleased that they're a community asset, so they're getting returned. We'll obviously take them all in the winter and give them a good clean up and count them. And if we need to replace any extras, we'll look at trying to do that as we need to. But no, it's really well received, either by people who simply can't afford a decent life jacket and you know, want to go out on a paddleboard or something like that, they've borrowed one off a mate, or people who have just forgotten them or didn't have enough for all their kids. I've got a three-year-old at home, and she seems to go through different sizes of clothing all the time, so keeping up with her size for a life jacket is not easy. So we're rolling out mooring licensing. So It's quite, I wouldn't say it's complicated. We've tried to really simplify it, but by simplifying it, we've split it into two streams. So if you've got a mooring anywhere in our region, it's either a resource consent or a mooring license. If you're inside a mooring area, you will require a mooring license in the future, or when your current coastal permit or resource consent expires, you'll need to transition to a mooring license. The mooring license system is a lot easier. It's a lot quicker process. It's an application online. It's a lot cheaper. However, there is an annual fee. Exactly the same fee as there is for a coastal permit. And then it's just reviewed every 5 years, whereas a coastal permit will last a lot longer, but you'll pay a lot more. So over the lifespan of your mooring, it works out about the same, but a lot simpler process.
So we're talking about regulation in that respect, but overall, one of the big things that the Harbour Master provides is education. Would that be a fair statement?
So I think what we really do is risk mitigation. So we're in the business of keeping people safe. We choose to do that risk mitigation via education. That's one of our big tools in our toolbox. Main reason we do that is because our area is simply too massive and we can't be everywhere all at once. So if we can educate people to do things right in the first place, we don't have any issues on the water. The second way we do it is obviously navigational aids on the water. So you'll see there's a lot of 5-knot floats around in summer, and then we've got a whole lot of permanent ones that we put over dangerous rocks and places that historically have caused a hazard. We've got, I think, close to 200 navigational aids that we monitor and look after around the region throughout the summer. And then our sort of final tool in our toolbox is that enforcement. So yes, we can issue on the spot fines on the water. We haven't had to do that yet. We've got a few that may end up going that way. We gather all the data on the water and can issue the fine later on. But like I say, we prefer to stick to education and get people to do the right thing through sort of, I guess, logic, and just keeping everyone safe. People want the waterways safe out there, and they want their mokopuna to swim at our beaches without fear of being run into.
So we're halfway through summer now. There's still a long way to go. What do you envisage is going to keep you guys busy in the next few weeks?
Well, I'd love to say we'd be on the water every day doing on-water patrolling. Reality is we will play it by ear with the weather. If it's a nice sunny day, we'll be on the water. Or we'll be at beaches doing education. This year we have got a new education officer, maritime education officer, who's been funded externally. So that's from Safer Boating New Zealand. So his job is basically to go around all these beaches, have a chat to people at beaches and at boat ramps, and fill in these safer boating surveys and have some really meaningful conversations. Obviously fills some of his time as crew on the boat as well, so you might see him on or off the water. Unfortunately, in the last 2 weeks, most of my time has been spent dealing with oil spills. I wear another hat called the Regional On-Scene Commander. So I've been dealing with a particular vessel in the Torrens Bay Estuary that did leak oil or oily water and diesel into that estuary. Pretty quick to respond, though. We got there within sort of 2 hours of the phone call going. We suspect the vessel did sink the previous day, but we know it was floating at least 48 hours prior to our phone call, so we know it wasn't sunk for a long period of time. Took us 3 days to get that vessel in a state fit to transport back to a storage yard and completely off the water and any contaminants cleaned up. My team did a brilliant job, and I'm pretty pleased, and hopefully we're able to say that no negative impacts on the environment were caused. At this stage, we can say we haven't found any negative impacts, but we are monitoring it each time we go by and having a look and making sure it's still the same. And then we had a second one as I was mid-report writing for that one, of a quad bike stuck in an estuary.
In the feedback, are there any particular issues or trends that help guide your work with policy?
Luckily, we were able to retrieve that one before the tide went over it that day. I think given that there was no footprints around the bike, it'd probably already gone over it that night. I think somebody had obviously joyriding in the mud at night and didn't report it to us. So yeah, we found out about it the next day and managed to drag it out of the mud before the tide went over it again. But yeah, all of these things add up to quite a cost to ratepayer, really. We can try and reimburse some costs if we can find the owner, and we can try and reimburse through the Oil Pollution Fund. But essentially, it's a big tab that we have to try and manage and mitigate, and it's obviously taking our time away from being on the water and doing the education that we really want to be up to.
So in that respect, the onus does fall back to anyone using any watercraft or near water in general to be safe but be responsible.
Yeah, definitely. I'd highly recommend anyone with a vessel or any sort of craft to get Coast Guard membership. They'll obviously cover costs of towing and looking after you guys, and they'll come rescue you. We're not really the ones that will come rescue you, although if we are on the water and we're the closest ones, of course we're going to come and help. However, when it comes to a marine oil spill, the costs add up really quickly, way more than the value of the vessel, certainly in this case. It's just the cost of doing business, I guess, of owning a boat. It's not cheap. The purchase price is often the cheapest part.
Tasman Harbour Master Pete Renshaw talking with Tim O'Connell, and you're listening to Tasman Report. Council is currently calling for feedback on the local alcohol policy, and I asked Kat Budai, our Community Policy Advisor, how often these reviews take place.
So we review the local alcohol policy every 6 years, and that's a timeline that's set out for us in the Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act. But it is the review is a really good opportunity for us to touch base with the community and just find out what their preferences are and if it's still aligned with our current policy. Feedback gives us a great insight into what our community values, and the process is set up to enable communities to be able to have their say. And then if there are any concerns, there'll often be a solution that will mitigate any of those risks as well.
So where do people give their feedback on the local alcohol policy?
They can. We're welcoming feedback from everyone in the community. We're looking for perspectives from a wide range of stakeholders. The best thing to do is to go to our Shape Tasman page on the local alcohol policy review. In our online surveys, we're asking the community to share their purchasing and consumption patterns, and that's so that we can gain a better understanding of whether their preferred habits are aligning with our current settings or what might potentially be proposed. But we're also asking for perceptions of alcohol harm in the community. So as I said, you know, we're collecting official sources from and subject matter expert information from Health NZ and the police, but we know that our residents are the experts of what it's like to live in their own communities. So we're really interested in what they have to say as well. And we're also doing some targeted checking in with our alcohol license holders, because we need to know what's working well for them and maybe if there's any tweaks that could improve the process for them as well. So while reducing alcohol harm is a key objective of this policy, it also helps to provide a more even playing field. And rather than assessing all alcohol licenses and their applications on a case-by-case basis, businesses can have like a bit more certainty when conditions are applied more consistently through the policy.
Kat, what happens to the information received from the feedback?
So we're going to be collecting early engagement feedback until mid-February, and then we'll be collating everything into a social impact assessment. That's something that we'll put back onto our SHAPE Tasman page so that everybody can see the same data that we're looking at to help inform the drafting of the policy. We'll be workshopping that with our councillors to gain their perspective and get a little bit of direction on where they want to see the policy go, and then we'll be coming back to the public so that they can have a say on what is written in the draft. That consultation will happen, the formal side of the consultation will happen in mid-June to mid-July.
That was Kat Budai, our Community Policy Advisor, talking about the call for feedback on our local alcohol policy. Now, some thoughts before we close on this. The Sale and Supply of Alcohol Act sets out some default parameters, like the hours alcohol can be sold. It provides the community with an opportunity to have their say on how alcohol is sold and supplied in their area, and sets conditions which work best for them. In some cases where the nighttime economy is particularly important, communities may be interested in extending the default hours that alcohol can be sold, or in other cases, maybe they want to reduce them to minimise alcohol harm. If you want to know more or to take part in the feedback, it's all online now at SHAPE Tasman. You're listening to Tasman Report, a fortnightly news wrap about what's happening in your council. Up next, Darren Palmer talks to Riley Peterson, our recovery support manager, about the ongoing recovery work from last year's June-July floods.
Welcome, Riley Peterson, our recovery support manager for emergency management. What, or was it just recovery support manager?
Yeah, Tasman District Council.
We are now more than 6 months after the big event.
Yeah.
It hasn't left our minds. It's still present. There's still a few of us working in the recovery.
Yeah.
This far into it, where are we at? What's happening right now?
It's funny, isn't it? Because people can forget that it sort of is still going on, but it's quite a focus at Tasman District Council, and there's quite a lot of work still going on. So the biggest amount of workers in the rivers space, they were the worst hit, and so that's quite a big thing. So what we're going to have is there will be crews working full-time in the rivers networks for the next 18 months to 2 years.
So that's a long time.
It's a really long time. So that shows you, that's full time. So that shows you how significant the damage is in those networks. So that's, yeah.
And that's rebuilding stock banks and,
yes,
and reforming,
yep,
and protecting
all that
where we can.
Yep, yep. And so what they're doing is they're starting in the highest risk areas first, and then they'll move down through that risk profile. They're also gearing up for a big willow planting this winter, and so that helps with resilience as well. So it's not just the big structural work, it's doing some softer resilience stuff, such as the planting.
So those plantings, cool. they retain banks, the stock banks?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The root networks hold on? And
yeah, and so they're kind of very keen this time to look at the river system as a holistic system network, rather than just something to be contained. They're wanting to give the river some space, but also use a lot of different ways to promote the resilience there. So they're doing that. And they're working on a high-level program about what that looks like for the next 18 months to 2 years at the moment, which will show which rivers they're working on and when. And they are planning to communicate that out to the public in March, so it's not far away.
Because they're working... Rivers are living beasts, aren't they? And I don't know if we all necessarily think of it as that.
That's
you think,
right.
Oh, it's a river, it's a meandering its way, isn't it? A lot pretty. But it's quite dynamic.
And that's the tension between people and the natural environment. Because rivers are, the banks of rivers and things are naturally fertile, but they're kind of a floodplain. So it's that tension between it. So you want to give the river some space to move and breathe, but you also need to know that there are people and communities and livelihoods that are on the in a river valley.
Mm.
So it's just working within those boundaries, really.
So rivers, main focus, major focus.
Yes.
Where else are we looking at? Where are we working and what's being done?
So roads, the roading network.
That got hammered.
And what they're about to do now is start on the big projects, the ones that cost a lot and need things like geotech assessments first before they can undertake work. So the big ticket items are about to start. The key focus at the moment is the Maraho Hill Road and the Motueka River West Bank Road. So those are the two areas that were really badly hit that they need to really think about how they recover those roads and the big work that needs to be done and the geotech side of things. So they're hoping to get most of that done by the end of this financial year, but some will, you know, carry over into the next financial year. And what I guess in the roading space, it does disrupt people, and we're very aware of that. But we're just asking people to be patient and kind to the workers who are out on there, you know, doing the hard yards. Because essentially it's trying to make people safe and property safe and being able to keep those routes open and make them a bit more resilient than they were. So we're always thinking about that too.
So it's looking ahead, planning ahead.
Yeah, so that's really important.
Yeah.
Waste is another big thing that happens following an emergency and takes a long time to recover. We're still working on some silt sites. That was quite a big thing with rivers. But as a whole, waste, and I've learned a lot about this, is kind of complex and multifaceted. So we've had a lot of horticultural silt, which we had to deal with. Other general silt that comes down from the rivers. We've had complex waste to deal with, so woody waste, you know, bits of trees and things, plastic, wire, fencing, all that sort of stuff.
It's all got to go somewhere.
And we're trying to recover some of that so that we can reuse it, not put it into the landfill. So that's been, you know, like sorting through all that waste has been a massive amount of time. Marine waste, that was really big. Like we recovered 450 whole apple bins and we got to return them back because they were stamped, and that was, and then I think it was 40 to 50 orchard nettings. So we're trying to make sure that we don't just dump everything into the landfill. We're kind of trying to recover that and reuse it or give it back to where it was.
And I guess then, that takes time too, doesn't it, to sort that out. And also storage space.
Yes.
We're having to hold it until we can find a solution for the disposal.
It's been big project to try and work out that. Yeah, so that's been big. And then in the social side of things, the social recovery has been really large. We had three navigators, so people that are brought in to help people walk through that journey of recovery if they're finding things really complex and difficult. And we helped 145 individuals or families, and it was fantastic. They've been really, really fantastic. So the last one is leaving next week, so that shows how long that's taken. We're also working on a flood stories book, which has been amazing, and some community members have contributed to this, telling their stories of the event, and we're going to try and provide a record of what happened, how people felt about it, what the, you know, the science behind it and that sort of thing. So that's underway at the moment, which is going to be a great thing to have, and it's a really important part of recovery is to have a record and have an outlet for people to tell their story and say how it is. And
have a reference.
Yeah,
to look back on it. Yeah, it's interesting because some of those stories I was involved with, and the stories of people, absolute devastation, and yet they, we're not as bad off as so-and-so down the road. Or stories of communities coming together. People, there's one line in it that stuck out at me. We're farmers, we're not good at talking, but now we know each other, and we've got a community.
Yeah.
And that was from one particular area.
Absolutely. And there's always things that you learn from each event, and you can identify that you've learned, and then you have to go through the process of doing something about the things that you learn. So that's a really important part of recovery is lessons, identifying the lessons and putting them in a place where you can learn from them and put them into place. And the other thing we're doing at the moment, it's just starting off, is pre-planning for recovery. So that's a lot of the work that I'm doing.
That's, because it will happen again.
Yeah.
I mean, history has shown us. Back from early times. Riley, thank you very much for your time today. We'll catch up in another couple of months and see how we're going.
Sounds good.
Brilliant.
That was Darren Palmer talking to Riley Peterson, our recovery support manager. And there is a great flood recovery information resource page on the council website. Access it by putting the words flood recovery into the search box, or under the My Region tab, click on Flood Recovery. See you back in a fortnight for another Tasman Report.
The podcast you just listened to was first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible.